Welcome everybody to tonight's webinar. The webinar tonight is on collaborative care for people with chronic pain and mental health issues. We have 250 attendees from all over Australia, and I would like to welcome each and every one of you tonight. As you know, this is an interdisciplinary panel discussion run by MHPN. Tonight, we have a very talented panel. We have Dr. Stephen Liao, who is a GP based in Adelaide, South Australia, with a special interest in diabetes and pain management. We have Nick Economos, who is a physiotherapist based in Sydney, with a special interest again in pain. Nick currently works in private practice at Empower Rehab. We have Dr. Jackie Stanford, who is a psychologist. Jackie provides training and supervision and return to work professionals about the management of clients with persistent pain. And we also have Dr. Toby Sachs, who is a pain psychiatrist practicing in Melbourne. And I'd just like to speak to each one of you briefly before we start. I think I'll start with you, Toby. You're a pain psychiatrist. Can you explain that?
Well, there's a difference between a general psychiatrist who tends to deal only with the mental health aspects of the chronic pain and a pain psychiatrist who's also a pain medicine specialist. I'm a pain medicine specialist as well, so I combine both skills in terms of pain management from the psychiatric psychological point of view and address both the physical and the psychological issues in my patients. Most general psychiatrists wouldn't have that approach and would be approaching only the mood part of the problem. And most pain specialists would be looking at addressing the pain as their primary concern and leaving the mood issues to another specialist to manage, a psychologist or a psychiatrist.
That's very interesting, Toby. So basically you're a psychiatrist-pain management consultant.
Yes.
Right. Thank you and welcome. Jackie. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
How did you first become involved in pain management? You're a psychologist.
It was the first job that I actually got at a rehabilitation hospital and worked in multiple areas of rehabilitation and found pain particularly interesting and so specialised in that area.
Great. You're very welcome tonight.
Thank you.
Nick, you're a physiotherapist. How did you first become involved in the psychology and the mind aspect of pain?
Look, I think having worked as a physio and become very frustrated over many years in dealing with some challenging clients, and especially some clients who weren't getting better, I really started to scratch my head and have a bit of a look around as to what, other than purely the physical, was influencing people's pain and through that and starting to work much more so with psychologists, learnt a lot more from them about their perspective on pain.
That's great. Thanks very much, Nick. That's very insightful. Stephen, you're very welcome from Adelaide. It must be freezing down there.
That it is.
How did you first become involved in pain management as a GP?
There was a project some years ago that got GPs into the pain management unit, and then from there there were certain unanswered questions and which started a fascination with pain, and since then I've joined the pain society. I've had dealings with the faculty of pain management of the College of Anaesthetists, and certainly also joined up with the International Association for Study of Pain, which I've been attending fairly regularly.
Thanks very much, Stephen. We're very grateful for your attendance tonight. My name is Dr. Michael Murray. I'm a GP in Townsville with a special interest in psychological medicine. By the way, Townsville tonight is quite chilly. It's about 17 degrees. We're expecting a low of 10 tonight. We did have a high of 21 today. The learning objectives for this evening. At the end of the session, participants can expect to have a better understanding of the relationship between mental health and chronic pain, a better understanding of the role of different disciplines in contributing to the assessment, treatment, and management of mental illness in people with chronic pain, and have explored tips and strategies for interdisciplinary collaboration in supporting people with mental health and chronic pain issues. Stephen, would you like to start your presentation?
Certainly. Thanks, Michael. Well, what strikes me in this case of Bron is the negative investigation results. GPs certainly have many patients where the people complain of pain, but when you investigate, you actually find nothing, which leaves the GP with a bit of a quandary about what you do with these patients. You don't seem to have anything to treat, and yet they still seem to be in pain. Then another key point is that this patient is not getting any better. They're not progressing. There's also a very common phenomenon when patients don't progress and you don't have any investigation results, you don't know what to treat with. So there's no action taken, and there's certainly no action taken in this patient for a very long time. And you can see that it simply just goes on and doesn't stop. But there are certainly a lot of the psychological yellow flags, and there are no of the physical red flags. And those two points are really important in dealing with this patient. Now, these negative investigation results, they are actually not uncommon in patients, but a lot of patients simply get better. Sometimes investigations cannot see the cause of the pain. You know, for example, x-rays cannot see muscles and so forth. Then there's the question that's in the GP's mind of, okay, we have negative results, so nothing is wrong. So why is the patient still in pain? Or where is the pain coming from? And leading this, okay, what action do you take? Do you simply give painkillers? Do you simply assume that it's inflammatory and give anti-inflammatory medication? And the last question is that, having done all of that, you wonder whether your treatment is actually justified or not. Are you actually doing anything? The patient is not progressing. So is the treatment actually working? Is it doing anything? Should you be doing something else? And certainly those are all questions in general practitioners' minds when you're faced with a situation like this. This failure to progress, she's not progressing with time, it's certainly a big warning that something is not right. And certainly you are utilizing a treatment regime which is clearly not working. And you all expect that there'll be certain markers of progress. For example, you know, if you strain a muscle, if you pull a muscle, within about a week or two, you should start seeing some improvement. If you break a bone, you expect to see some improvement in a given time frame, and so forth. Now, these time markers or expectations of progress are simply not here on this case. So there's something more to this than meets the eye. It is not simply, you know, a physical injury. So no action at the three-month mark, a warning bell should be going off. In most cases, there should be healing taking place here. A close assessment at this time would identify the risk factors for progression to chronic pain. These are all these yellow flags, these psychological yellow flags that are present in Bron but not recognized. And if a GP cannot identify risk factors, I feel that a multi-D approach should be undertaken, certainly at this time. So these yellow flags are certainly indications of progression to chronic pain. Now, just being on workers' compensation is a yellow flag. It has an increased risk of developing chronic pain. Now, a very supportive spouse is wonderful, but it's actually another risk factor to progression to chronic pain. Catastrophizing, you know, the fact that everything is bad, it's not progressing, almost building negative castles in the air. That, again, is a warning sign. Now, the fact that she says the physio really understands me, which means to me that the doctor doesn't understand me. The physio understands me, the doctor doesn't. And the focus on the cure and the physical disease in this woman, certainly all of them are big warning factors, and they should be picked up. But often they're left on the wayside. People don't recognize them as actually factors that would lead to progression to chronic pain, and they go largely unnoticed. So in summary, the thing is that most patients actually get better, but Bron is actually quite common. She's not an uncommon scenario in general practice. The failure to act is the most damaging aspect of this case. The negative results tend to confuse the issue, and certainly there is a notion that injury equals pain. Therefore, you cure the injury and the pain goes away. That certainly is not the case in some patients. Also, that pain is an experience and it's not a sensation. And the ISP certainly pushes the fact that pain is an experience and is dependent on many, many other factors apart from just simply physical injury. It is not a simple model like Descartes would indicate, you know, where you get a fire on your foot and this almost immediate response to your brain and pain, and that's it. There's a lot more to pain than that. And certainly the impact of the psychological factors on pain is all important.
Thank you very much, Stephen. That was a very insightful presentation. Lots of information there. For our people, for our attendees out there all over Australia, please don't hesitate to put messages or questions into the message screen. We will be putting those to the panel during the interdisciplinary conversation after the presentations. And now I'd just like to move on to our specialist physiotherapist, Mr. Nick Economus. Nick, here, I'll just move on to your slides. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Michael. Look, and just to clarify before, Michael, that I'm actually based in Melbourne, not Sydney, although I was born and bred in Sydney and lived there for the first 20-something years of my life.
Sorry, that's a cardinal sin. I'm very sorry about that.
That's okay. I have two feet in, one feet in each camp when it comes to the Sydney-Melbourne debate there. So thanks, Michael. Now, really, I'll break my presentation into an assessment component and a management component. From an assessment perspective, if I was to see someone like Bron, the main focus for me would be that the predominant aspect of the treatment so far really has been very passive in its nature, and passive in the application of some of the treatment techniques and passive in the role that Bron is taking in managing her situation to improve her functioning. And we know that as time goes on, that sort of passive approach doesn't have a lot of support in the evidence, and certainly managing chronic pain doesn't seem to work too well. Now, she has knee and back pain, but that are continuing despite innocuous scans. And those scans have essentially cleared her of any sort of sinister pathology or anything that might require further intervention, but clearly she still has real pain despite any scan giving us any clues as to why that is. One of the things that I would be encouraging other physios to do, and a lot of physios do now, is having someone like Bron complete an Erebro questionnaire, which really looks at identifying some of the psychosocial factors that might predispose someone to developing chronic pain. And in this situation here, Bron has demonstrated that she has a whole range of psychosocial factors that are putting her at a higher risk of developing chronic pain. And she well and truly has developed chronic pain as it is anyway, purely based on the time. And we know that with that, a coordinated approach is really important, that just a physio on their own probably isn't going to produce some great results. The other interesting thing that Stephen raised before was that that Bron was mentioning that the current physiotherapy treatment is good in that it allows Bron to feel that she's been listened to and that she's been understood by the physio. But given the lack of progress, I wonder whether that intervention is more providing some sort of supportive counselling and social contact, given the changes to Bron's lifestyle, rather than any sort of active treatment as such. So if I was to look at management, the first thing that I would focus on with Bron would be providing her with some education as to why her pain does still persist, and certainly we know when we look at things like central sensitization and explanations of pain based on pain neurophysiology, that explains a lot more about why chronic pain persists than the biology in bronze situation where the scans are quite real. But with that, it would be very important to explain to Bron that clearly her pain is real. I do believe her 100%. It just is persisting for other reasons. And there are a range of biopsychosocial reasons as to why the pain persists. But the treatment approach would need to shift from a very passive approach where I'm doing things to her to a much more active approach where I'm encouraging her to go on to take much more of a role in her own recovery. And the pain education would allow for that to make sense. Now, part of that is really to look at the importance of increasing Bron's functioning and assisting her to re-engage in meaningful activities as a means to reducing her pain, to managing the pain better, and to improving her function. And the first step in that would be to setting some specific goals. Now, I'm sure most listeners would be very familiar with SMART goals. I'm not sure how often it's actually practiced in actually sitting down with someone and developing some really clear goals that are realistic and achievable in a relatively shortish term, perhaps 4 to 6 weeks, and communicating that with other treaters too. So communicating that with perhaps the GP or with a psychologist if they're involved at the stage. Now, one of the key components of the treatment that as a physio I'd be involved in is really providing a graded exposure approach to movement through exercise, but also through gradual increases in activity levels. So Bron enjoyed the cooking, the roast, and walking and dancing, and was working previously, and was completing some of her household chores. So breaking those activities down into bite-sized chunks and looking at how we can gradually introduce some of those components, whether it's with some assistance initially, and then with gradually reducing assistance so that she can become more independent in doing some of those activities. Looking at the benefits of returning to work, and there's certainly plenty of evidence around now that for most people getting back to work provides physical and psychological benefits. So looking at problem solving the barriers as to why Bron may not be able to return to work, and looking at what the other options may well be to facilitate an earlier return to work, whether it's providing the employer providing some alternative students to make it more likely for her to return to work on reduced hours and other types of duties so that she can re-engage the workplace with her old workmates as well as an important part of her recovery. And then a really important component of the treatment would be communicating with those other treaters regarding the goals, but also the intervention that's being provided, and also with perhaps her employer or with her insurer to look at developing a plan for her to return to work. And lastly, developing self-management strategies, which start really from the start, but would occur throughout the treatment program. So it may be something as simple as giving her a massage ball that she can actually use herself so that if she feels that her pain is affecting her and she is very used to having the passive physio treatment, that perhaps she could use a massage ball as one of many strategies to provide some sort of self-massage that she can do whenever she likes, wherever she likes, without too much effort, without requiring the reliance of seeing a physiotherapist perform a similar sort of treatment approach as well. That's all from me, Michael.
Thanks very much, Nick. I was very impressed with that presentation, particularly with the communication with the patient and with the other disciplines and with the insurers, of course, and employers. Thank you very much for that. And now, Jackie, we'll move on to your presentation.
Thank you. And when I'm assessing a client, I'm going to look at it in the two ways as well, the assessment and the treatment. In the assessment phase, I do a standard psychosocial assessment. That's looking at the usual questions that a psychologist would ask around mood, sleep, family, lifestyle factors. In terms of the pain specifically, though, I'd be exploring things around what was happening at the time of injury that may have precipitated the presentation, may have precipitated the injury, what was happening in the workplace, what was happening stress-wise at that time. One of the key things that's really important, though, in this is to really validate the client's experience of pain, that their pain is real. There's no way that we can ever measure pain directly. There's no scan, there's no test. So what they say is the pain they're experiencing. And particularly when they come to see a psychologist, the clients can often feel like you're saying the pain's all in their head, it's not real, and that validation at the start is a really important part of it. It's also important in the assessment phase to gain an understanding about their beliefs about pain. Do they believe there's still ongoing damage and harm? Do they believe they've got any control over their pain, or that their pain completely controls them? Do they feel like they can function or completely disabled? Are they still seeking a cure? And Bronze, in the case study, completed the SOPA, the Survey of Pain Attitudes, which is a measure that looks at some of those beliefs, and there's many other outcome measures that can help add to that clinical assessment. Because really, shifting those beliefs and understanding needs to be a core component of treatment. Gaining an understanding of the impact of the pain on function, so understanding for Bron that she's not able to cook for family meals and have go to dancing and some of those things, is really important, because we know that engaging in function, enjoyable activities, is important in managing pain. And in addition, getting a sense of where she's at in the acceptance process. So Bron, quite obviously, isn't accepting very much of the changes that have happened. There's significant changes, and she's still quite focused on the way I used to be. So getting a sense of that with the client is important in the assessment phase. Following the assessment phase, what I then do is look at it through a formulation lens, and many psychologists will be familiar with this model, but it's really identifying what are the predisposing and precipitating factors that have contributed to the presentation. So what has predisposed or precipitated on having the ongoing pain and the significant limitations to function. Now, these two areas, because they're past, you can't directly change them, but they're important to understand because there may be some ongoing implications for them. The main sort of area where we target is the perpetuating factors. So these are the factors that are maintaining it, such as potentially an overly supportive husband, avoiding activities, fear of pain, so therefore avoiding any activities because it might exacerbate the pain that Bond's experiencing, feeling out of control. And then also to identify the protective factors, the factors that we can use to help Bond move forward, engaging in that meaningful life that she feels like she's lost. And so intervention would aim to increase each of these factors. Following the formulation, it's then pulling it into sort of a goals and a treatment plan. And as Nick talked about, developing SMART goals, really functional goals. For me, this has been a bit of a challenge as a psychologist, because I sort of started off with my goals used to be, you know, improve mood, decrease pain. And that's often what a client will come in and say, they want to feel better. It's then going, looking at, exploring with the client, so what, why, what would that mean? If your pain was less, what would you want to do? How would you know that's achieved? Particularly because clients often get very focused on the pain, they may not notice an improvement, whereas when you can look at some really clear functional achievements, they can start realising, hey, I've still got pain, but I'm doing a lot more. I'm engaging in life with the same amount of pain. If I had the choice, I'd have no pain, but the pain's there. I might have, at least I'm living my life and engaging in things. In addition, engaging in those family things, the important value-based activities, also create a sense of meaning and purpose and can release endorphins and that help manage pain. It's really important that the goals develop for the client, not the therapist, not work covers, not anyone else's. Yet often they can easily work together towards achieving the same goals. They've got to be meaningful to the client. And it's important to look at things like work, but also social and leisure activities. Now, because the goals of the client, it doesn't need to be, as a psychologist, I have my goals, the physio has theirs, the GP has theirs. If we share the goals, we can all bring our knowledge and our strategy to help someone like Bron achieve them. So the formulation and the goals should shape the treatment plan. In terms of treatment, it's really important that the biopsychosocial approach is taken where it is integrated. It's not a bit of bio and then a bit of psycho and a bit of social. It really is looking at Bron as a whole person, going, okay, what are the barriers? The ongoing pain is a problem, depression and feeling of helplessness is a problem, withdrawal from social is a problem, and they all feed into each other. We can't slice Bron into sections. And I suppose that sort of reinforcement of the importance of communication with other stakeholders or treatment providers to ensure that that holistic approach is taken. In terms of actual treatment, there's very strong evidence supporting the use of cognitive behaviour therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy in the management of pain. I would use a mix of both depending on the key perpetuating factors. From a cognitive behaviour therapy approach, it would be looking at shifting their beliefs, their understanding, their thoughts around the pain. So I can't do things, making it more realistic, such as I'm finding it hard to do things, using things like relaxation. Relaxation as a treatment modality on its own has been found effective in helping reduce pain. So it's a really cool component that clients become confident in self-management. Acceptance and commitment therapy across the board has become popular, and there's a lot of research over the last 10, 15 years specifically with pain, and I find it really helpful because of the focus on acceptance. So for someone like Blum, accepting the change and accepting the pain sensation experience that she's having, and also helping her move forward into value-based actions, so moving forward into things that are important, which reinforces the importance of that functional focus. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jackie. That was a fantastic presentation. I was very much taken with your comments about being client focused, particularly in relation to their goals. And it's also interesting how useful acceptance and commitment therapy is in so many different situations, but particularly in pain. Thank you very much for that. And now, Toby, we'll just move on to your presentation. Thanks.
Okay. From my point of view, I'd be doing very much the same as both Nick and Jackie in terms of the assessment phase, so I've not really looked at that. These patients usually come to me at this end point where they've had chronic pain for a while, and in a sense, everybody is trying to work on how to deal with either the pain or the depression. From my perspective, Bron has decompensated. She's not able to cope with the persistent pain, nor is she coping with the consequences of the pain in terms of disability and the handicap that goes with it. She's become depressed because of that. She's given up. And so she's developed, from my point of view as a psychiatrist, an adjustment disorder for anxiety and depressed mood. It's important that this is different from a major depression for psychiatrists, because essentially this is not a problem with the serotonergic system. This is a problem that arises as a result of pain. And she is not coping with the pain, primarily because she has no understanding of it. Her failure to adjust the pain, as I've written in the slide, is due to her lack of understanding about what the nature of her pain is. She believes the persistent pain reflects continuing damage. Now, from a psychiatrist's point of view, pain is more than just an unpleasant sensation, as Stephen said. It is an unpleasant sensation that means something. It means something to the person. There's a cognitive evaluative component. This involves anticipation, attention, suggestion, and all her past experience modulate into how she experiences this pain. And then it also has the effect on behavior and her psychology, what it makes her feel, how it makes her do things. And that's a motivational affective component, where at this stage she feels nothing she's done or anything that her doctors have done have actually helped her move on. So she lacks any effective strategies to deal with her pain when it arises or flares up, other than resorting to passive strategies like taking medication or depending on the physio to do the massage. She has become kinesiophobic. She's afraid of moving. Everything she does hurts. And for her, hurt means that she's doing damage. And so she's reducing her sphere of activity. She's no longer fear. Her sense of self-efficacy has been reduced. Her self-esteem is reduced. She's no longer working. She is no longer a valid person. And I think that component about validating her pain is particularly important, because she has become an invalid, a person who's no longer validated, and as a result has become totally demoralized. Furthermore, she doesn't have any strategies or avenues to grieve for to deal with the losses, both personal, financial, and emotional. And as a consequence, she has feelings of helplessness, hopelessness, and despair, which are very consistent with the diagnosis of depression, except when you see it in this context. Now, if Bron were referred to me, I would be focusing on two things. First, greatly reducing her emotional distress. I would do this by providing her with hope and understanding, providing with information about what underlying pathology is, that her brain has changed its way of functioning in relation to the pain that she has. There has become a situation called central sensitization, where the pain pathways that reflect the area where it's been injured become, in a sense, amplified. I would facilitate her getting a better understanding of the relation between her pain, the sensation of pain, how she feels, what the pain makes her think and feel, and her behaviors, how it affects her gait, her posture, and several other behaviors, including social withdrawal. Now, I've suggested on the slide that I might also introduce an antidepressant drug. Antidepressants have a specific role in chronic pain. Not only do they address the mood issue, but certain of the antidepressants, particularly those that are serotonin noradrenergic, SNRIs, are actually effective in reducing pain sensation. So certain drugs are actually more effective than others. Some of the older drugs, like the tricyclics, also do this and also assist with sleep, which is often a big problem for chronic pain people. They're not sleeping very well. I would also be looking at deconditioning her responses to pain by looking at providing her self-management strategies, things that are relaxation-based, like meditation-based strategies, and also strategies like Nick suggested of self-massaging and, in a sense, moving the limb as much as possible. Once I've given her an explanation of how the muscles are involved in her pain, she should be able to do this more readily. I'd be also focusing on reducing her reliance on medications if she is on some. Fortunately, in this case, Ronnie is not on a lot because the GP has only given her some paracetamol. But I'll also be looking at that by attending the physio and looking to him for passive treatment. She's not really becoming active in her own rehabilitation. And then I'd also be addressing the change in the social environment contingencies that enhance her sick role behaviors. Things like Bill taking over all her former domestic activities and, in a sense, making her even less valid and sidelining her even more in the family and therefore increasing her distress rather than reducing it. Lastly, and again, Nick also addressed this, I'll be facilitating her re-engagement in normal, meaningful activities, encouraging her to become a more active participant in her own recovery with exercise, movement, and begin gradually reinstating activities in her home. I would look at trying to get her to start going out more. She would be saying that she's in pain, but I'd be getting her to use her strategies to deal with this. The most important things to think about in these sort of cases are that anxiety and depression, sorry, I've gone forward one slide too many, anxiety and depression are both very common in patients with chronic pain. Chronic pain both aggravates the pain. The more pain they're in, the more distress they have. But it's also aggravated by anxiety and depression. And in certain cases, such as with tension, headaches, and other things, it can, in fact, lead on to depression, and anxiety and depression can lead on to tension headaches, which can become chronic. So it goes both ways. In summary, treatment of patients with chronic pain needs to address not only management of the pain itself, but also the emotions and behaviors that go with it, and that go with it as a result of changes in the person's circumstances, and secondly, their erroneous or mistaken beliefs and expectations, which is more important about the pain. They expect it to go away. They expect the doctor to be able to take it away. And lastly, the point about that, if we do these things as monotherapy, so physical treatment alone would fail. Nick is addressing both the psychosocial and the physical things. Passive treatments, we've all seen, fail. And psychotherapy alone, without addressing the physical things, also fail. Over to you, Michael.
Thank you very much, Toby. That was a fascinating presentation, and I'm sure everybody has taken your points on board. We're now moving into the phase of the webinar where we have a panel discussion, and we'll first start off with some questions for each other, and I believe, Stephen, our GP, that you have a question for our physio in relation to the role of physiotherapy in cases of long-standing pain. May I ask you just to elaborate on that?
Yes,
Yes, certainly. I'm curious as to what a physiotherapist can offer, you know, with somebody with pain that's been going on for a very long time. I mean, do you get improvement in function, you know, with very long... I find patients with pain for a very long time very, very resistant to doing anything. Physiotherapy might hurt and might cause pain. So whether they are actually open to treatment, for example, and what results you would get from the average patient if there's such a thing.
Yeah, Stephen, I think I guess it depends on how you define physiotherapy. I think generally speaking, most physiotherapists still have a take on a very passive approach in treating someone like Bron, and would predominantly provide hands-on treatment, electrotherapy, those sorts of things as the predominant treatment approach, which with someone like Bron, I'd really steer away from and look at a much more active approach. Now, as you said there, that one of the challenges is that asking someone who has pain to move is likely to increase their pain. And so what I'd focus on is how we could perhaps look at breaking that task down into smaller, more manageable components of that task. So as an example, for someone like Bron, perhaps who couldn't put her shoes and socks on independently, perhaps required her husband to help her with that, I might have her simulating that movement of bringing her knee up towards her chest, but perhaps in a different position, like lying down, where she might feel she is able to do that, that the activity is less threatening, and is a little bit too different from the real activity of putting her shoes and socks on, and then look at progressing that to a more upright position, perhaps then actually using a shoe or a sock. So a combination of the exercise and the stretch, as well as the link to the actual activity that she's wanting to perform once again. And with that, always asking Bron what she understands of that pain when she's actually performing that exercise or that activity. If it's hurting, what does she understand based on the education that I've provided to her about her pain? If she then goes back to that old belief that I think I'm breaking my back, I'm damaging something, we'd re-look at that and review the education that's been provided to reduce some of her fears that further pain equates to further harm.
Thanks very much. Very good reply, very good question. Jackie, I believe that you have a question for Toby around about medication reviews, because there are very few psychiatrists who understand both psychiatry and pain, so perhaps this may be an opportunity for you to ask that question.
Yeah, one of the challenges I find with clients when they're medication reviewed, almost everyone throws part of it, saying too hard, either the pain side or the mood side. So, Toby, what would your recommendation be in trying to either find psychiatrists or pain specialists that have an understanding of both, or how to more effectively to communicate with psychiatrists or pain specialists with medication reviews when there is both the pain and the mental health issues?
It's a very difficult thing, because a lot of psychiatrists don't really know a lot about the pain medication. They would be able to do all the reviews in terms of the psychotropics. However, again, from their position, quite often what they see in patients like Bron is simply the depression, and they see the pain as a factor that's perpetuating the depression, but they don't actually look at directly treating it other than by using medications like analgesics. By and large, many psychiatrists tend to use too large doses of most medications, which is often a problem. The medication required in chronic pain for antidepressants is unusually low. We use, for example, with the tricyclics, amitriptyline or NDEP, doses of 5 to 10 milligrams, whereas for depression, the dose would be 150 milligrams. Similarly, with some of the more specific antidepressants used, the dose is usually lower rather than higher, because at a higher level they're getting more side effects and then need even more medications to treat the side effects. Similarly, there are problems with the opiates, the painkillers, the analgesics they use. For many psychiatrists, they are trying to look at controlling the pain completely with the analgesics. It's a fairly hopeless process, because the more medication you give them, the more tolerant they become, the more medication they then require. So in effect, they will tend to try and stabilize the medication at a certain level. But as I said, they will be able to manage the effect component of this reasonably well.
Thanks very much. Very good question. Very good answer. Stephen, I believe that you had a question for Jackie in relation to therapeutic inertia, as to how the psychologist may help the GP in relation to therapeutic inertia. Could you expand on that, please?
Certainly. The notion of therapeutic inertia, taking action when you should be taking action, not sort of delaying it. I just wondered, how this can be facilitated. It's a difficult link, and the thing is that not many people are aware about the role of, for example, psychology and physiotherapy in the treatment of chronic pain. So what can we do to sort of facilitate this? How can we make the general practice population aware of this?
Aware of the role of psychology in that aspect, or what can the GP be doing to address the issue of inertia?
Both. I mean,
yep.
To be able to push the issue, to be able to actually take action, and to actually have knowledge about the role of psychology.
And I think you raise a really good point that psychology is often seen just as a mental health discipline, that's what our role is. So once the adjustment disorder has officially met the criteria, or the depression or the sleep is severe enough, that's often when we get referrals. Whereas as a psychologist, we specialise in behaviour change and looking at thoughts and emotions right along the spectrum. So in terms of the inertia, I find that having those really clear functional goals is a really critical aspect, because either it allows you to move forward, it gives a direction that everyone can be part of, but I suppose more importantly, when you've got the functional goals and you have the review and they're not being achieved, it raises a really good opportunity to explore the why. What are the barriers? What's holding you back at the moment? Because ideally the client will agree to the goals or the direction taken, but may not then follow through. So the conversation can be had around that of, okay, how do we work with this? You're wanting to move forward, but there's obviously something in you that's stopping you. Because often the client's not directly aware of that themselves. Once that is identified, then that can either be an avenue to address or to refer on. So it may be that fear of pain, or I've had clients say to me, part of me is scared to get better because I've been like this for so long. Trying to draw out what are those barriers that are actually holding it. And I find that if you don't have that functional focus, you don't really know whether you're moving anywhere at all.
Thanks very much. Very good question. Again, very, very good answer. I'm often reminded of Munch's picture of the scream with the person on the bridge. But there's another person in this scenario, isn't there? And I think, Nick, you wanted to ask Toby about Bron's husband. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, look, Toby, I was just wondering how you'd focus or how you would address Bron's husband's intent to look after her.
The way I usually approach this is that the very first interview I have with the patient, which is really focused on psychoeducation, which is focused on what is acute pain, what is a chronic pain, how does acute pain become chronic pain, tends to reflect on the fact that essentially lack of activity will actually aggravate the pain. And getting them to understand that a lot of the responses that both he and Bron are doing are about protective things, which are appropriate for acute pain. You don't move it because you're trying to protect it in the healing phase. So I'd be pointing out to him that the more he takes over her task, not only is he preventing her from the activity, and that is going to cause her to have more doubt about her activity and be more concerned about pain when it occurs, but he's also, in a sense, taking over her role. And therefore, from a mood point of view, he's leaving her with no focus and no meaning in her life. So I'd be trying to get him to encourage her to be more active, to do things with her rather than for her. And again, this would be clear, fairly clear after the psychoed session, because again, in that, I point out that fear and anxiety are what's maintaining her pain. They're maintaining her muscles in a state of muscle hypertonus. The tighter her muscles are and the more they ache, the less she wants to do. But effectively, like anyone who's been stiff after exercise, they know that if they keep still for too long, they'll get even more stiff. So again, by increasing his understanding about what chronic pain is and what sort of things are going to help her and how helping her help herself is a lot better than someone else doing it for her, I'll get him to become a co-therapist with her. My goal with many of these patients is to make them become their own therapist, to help them learn how to manage their pain. They manage their pain as a diabetic manages their diabetes. And as a diabetic's partner cannot actually monitor what they eat and everything and keep stopping them. So I point out that a pain patient's partner can't be doing everything for them because that's not really helping. I find some are resistant, particularly when work cover's involved, because, again, quite frequently there's reinforcement of this behavior by work cover allowing them to become an official carer, which then means both of them stay at home and do the work of one. But it, for both people, it has major consequences in terms of their self-esteem and their way of looking at themselves. He will no longer be a nurse as such. He'll be a personal carer. For her, she's no longer being able to be someone who's an active contributor both in the family and in the workforce. So we need to re-encourage those things. And as I said, that's how I'd be addressing with the patient and the partner.
That's great. Thank you both. And certainly that does emphasize the role of psychoeducation, and education probably is a role that we all tend to neglect at times when things are bad. Jackie, I believe that you have a question for Stephen in relation to communicating with GPs. So about how psychologists should communicate with GPs. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, Stephen, I'd be interested in your thoughts on how we can communicate more effectively with GPs, in particular to start shifting that view that psychologists have a role earlier on in managing pain, whether it be the psychologist communicating with the GP or the physiotherapist. What do you see that can be done to help shift that view that we do also work with more than mental health issues and adjustment disorders?
Certainly, I think it's to do with education. The GPs simply do not know, as you say, they do not know that the service is available. They get stuck, you know, in terms of bronze cases, a particularly common scenario where GP rolls along, patient doesn't progress. So they continue more of the same. Patient still doesn't progress. They continue more of the same again. Not aware of, you know, the services that are available, not aware that you can actually do something. So the patient just rolls on. And the worst possible scenario, they just keep on rolling on forever and nothing happens, nothing changes. The patient gets worse and worse. Suddenly the misuse syndromes all start to set in and then you get a very, very difficult patient to deal with once you really start looking at the issues, once they actually start. So I look at maybe education in the undergraduate sector, education in the postgraduate, and education in GPs, because they are really the first point of contact with all of these patients. Education in the RECGP curriculum as well, in treating pain, in looking at the multi-D treatment. I think there are moves that are positive in this regard, and I think that things are happening, but unfortunately, a little bit too slowly. And I think that a lot of GPs are simply rooted in this idea of disease and pain, and disease equals pain. So you cure the disease, the pain will go. If you've got pain, you've got no disease, something is wrong somewhere. Hopefully they treat something is wrong and they can actually refer that to the right person.
Thank you.
We had I'm just going to throw this question open to the whole panel with a really good question come through from Kathleen Pierce. Do we have any statistics to support the suggestion that workover may promote learned helplessness?
Not that I know of. We keep trying to tell them that, but I don't think they actually understand what their delay tactics actually do and how much the whole litigation process and their process of trying to invalidate the patient actually diverts the patient's attention from actually focusing on getting better. They focus instead on being validated, on proving they got pain. So workover's aware of it, but don't seem to have any clear idea of what to do about it, I don't think.
Look, I mean, I'd like to add to that as well, Michael, and I do some advisory work with workover, and I guess they're in a bit of a bind term, and I certainly don't often manage cases particularly well, I think, as Toby alluded to. But they're often in a situation where there might be treaters who are recommending practices that aren't probably best practice, but they may be in a difficult situation to reject the funding of that treatment, even though it's perhaps ongoing passive treatment or the like. So, you know, it's certainly not an ideal system, but I think it's a bit more complicated than just simply the workover system. It's the employer that the supervisor that's rolled their eyes on the first day of the injury that might be adding to that, as well as colleagues or friends or others as well. I think it's such a broad range of issues in a client who's funded by workover that may lead to worse outcomes, and certainly validation is one of the key ones there. But I don't think it's only the case manager who's involved in that.
It's the whole system, Nick. The whole system works towards, in a sense, invalidating it and in a sense, changing the focus of what treatment should be from treatment to, in a sense, funding. It's like any third-party program.
Stephen, how do you go about writing the work cover certificate? I mean, this all comes into it, doesn't it? It's a ceremony. How do you approach that in the wider context that we're talking about tonight?
I think the workover certificate often falls back into the lap of GPs. The patient presents, I've got pain, I can't go back to work. GP signs the certificate for 1 month. And then they come back in next month and say, I still got pain, I still cannot work, it's still painful, and what can you do to cure it? Nothing. So you sign another certificate, and I think it just goes on and on. And certainly I think being on workers' compensation, this whole idea of pecuniary gain has been identified by many people as a risk factor to developing chronic pain. Unfortunately, you know, as the others have added, it is the system that we are in, and unfortunately we have to deal with the system. It's a very difficult one to separate.
Jackie, do you have any comments on it?
I suppose my flag would be to be careful that as treaters we don't inadvertently exacerbate that stress by projecting our own frustrations with the system and providing too much empathy or validation to it. I find often when I engage with case managers, with the insurers, even verbally, like speak phone with the client, you can actually start helping things move forward. So, yes, the system's not perfect, but I think it's important that we don't inadvertently perpetuate the stress for the client.
Yeah. Well, I suppose one of our roles is to be a patient advocate. I mean, in that sense, not only are you trying to treat the patient, but you're trying to advocate with a third-party payer that they actually get the best possible treatment. At the same time, often with the certificates, it's really important that one realise that although they've got pain, they're not necessarily 100% unfit to return to work, and that, you know, some sort of clear plan to return to work is part of the whole parcel. I mean, after all, that's what the insurer pays for, is to try and help them return to work, not to compensate them as the end result. And for most patients, that's actually what they want, but they still get very frustrated by the whole system, which is extremely pedantic and extremely full with lots of pieces of paper. I mean, you know, not only are they doing the work cover certificate, but every time they see a doctor, they're sending in forms or getting transport. Or it's a very, very paper-heavy process.
Nick, how do you manage patients whom you're referring on to a psychologist? I mean, how do you actually broach that?
I guess one of the easier ways I find is if I have had a patient complete something like an Erebro questionnaire or some other similar risk questionnaire that looks at yellow flags, looks at psychosocial factors that may be impacting on someone's recovery, then it's much easier to have that conversation to say, look, I'm looking at you as a whole person, not just as a back or as a knee, and what this questionnaire is telling me is that from how you've answered that, is that you're reporting that you're quite anxious or depressed, because that's what these sort of questionnaires look at, it can be very useful to look at including the involvement of a psychologist to assist my role in helping you to recover. It may well be around sleep issues. It may well be around someone who I saw recently who was reporting flashbacks following a car accident, 2 or 3 months following a car accident, and so using that as an opening to say, look, I'm a physiotherapist, that's not my area of specialty, but it's important for your recovery that we do look at you as a whole person, and it's difficult to do that without the involvement of psychologists in your situation. The other component to that is when I go through the explaining how the pain system works, so to speak, I'd be really looking at explaining how both the physical and the psychological and the social factors can influence and perpetuate the pain cycle and the dysfunction, and again use that as an opening to highlight the importance of having others involved in the person's care.
We had some spirited texts earlier on during your presentation, Stephen, when you describe pain as an experience. Would any of the panel like to comment on that? What is pain? Is it the experience? Is it a sensation? Is it we hear these gateways?
I think we often think of pain as what we should actually label nociception, that you have a mechanism for pain, but then that mechanism communicates a message to your brain, and your brain adds on that nasty feeling which we all associate with pain. And it's that nasty feeling, as opposed to just a feeling, that we associate with pain. And that nasty feeling can be modulated by many, many factors. It goes through many connections before that message is sent to the brain. The psychological factors become really important, because they certainly determine what we feel as pain or what we don't feel as pain. I'm interested in the others' comments on this.
Yeah, well, I from my perspective, as I say, pain is a complex thing. It's due to the fact that pain precipitates a fight or flight response. And it's the perpetuation, the flight-fight response, that results in all pain symptoms, from the shortness of breath, the palpitations, the nausea, the hot and cold flushes, the frequency of micturition, the bowel irritability. All of those symptoms are really secondary to what would be normal in a fight-flight response. In acute pain, the flight-fight response is therapeutic, and it's actually a very much protective response and reflex. But in chronic pain, that reflex becomes pathological, and it's that process that actually sets up both the emotional, psychological, and, in fact, to a large extent, some of the spiritual components of chronic pain. People think that they must be bad to have this. They think that, God must hate them somehow, right? Mm-hmm. But it's really about getting them to see that all those factors are driven by what is a very simple response in humans, the fight-flight response, that same response is also precipitated by anxiety, which therefore aggravates their pain, by anger, which therefore aggravates their pain, and by stress, or such as dealing with the work cover system or litigation, which precipitates fear and anxiety and aggravates their pain. So if you understand that that's what the pathology is that it's a perpetuated flight-fight response, then one can actually understand most of the symptoms, and so can the patient. And the treatment then becomes dealing with that fight-flight response. In fact, modifying what is a instinctive response, which is no longer useful.
Thanks very much. Nick, your comments on pain. Is pain an experience? Multifaceted?
Yeah, look, there's no doubt it's multifaceted, and I guess the most important thing is again that it's very real, and so it's what the individual says it is, and no one out there can tell if my face is in pain right now, and neither can I of those that I can see anyway. It's something it's important that we do believe what someone says, and you know, many times I've had patients who've come to me who would be sitting next to me who'd say my pain is right now is 10 out of 10 or perhaps even 12 out of 10, and when I explain to them, re-explain the pain scale, and they look at me straight in the face without any obvious sense of discomfort that they're in pain, I again 100% believe that they're in pain. Now, whether that is the sort of pain we might associate with pure physical pain, or whether it's sort of psychological pain, it doesn't really matter. It's just that sort of that broad spectrum of I'm not coping, I'm distressed, I'm struggling, and whether it's an acute ankle sprain or whether it's a chronic debilitating condition or chronic fatigue syndrome, a fibromyalgia type syndrome, it doesn't really matter. It's what the client says it is. And certainly, there are usually lots of drivers to the pain experience that we need to unpack as clinicians.
Thanks very much, Nick. Jackie, what is pain?
Complex. I think it just comes down to what they said. We can't separate the biopsychosocial. It's what they're going through. It's their experience or it's their sensation. Whatever language helps them feel like they're understood. And either way, everyone's pain is unique, and you're looking at specific factors for them that are perpetuating it. So as Toby said, whether it's the anger, the stress, or whether it's overdoing activities, whatever it is, it's individual for each person.
Nick, in your experience as a physio, seeing people coming in on medications, could you comment on medications? Your perception as a professional, seeing people coming in on medications, are people being adequately over medicated? Are they being under medicated or over medicated, or does it vary a lot?
Look, I think it does vary. I mean, there may be some who would seem to benefit from taking some medication perhaps more regularly to facilitate their rehabilitation, so not as the only intervention, but perhaps to get them moving, get them re-engaging in activity, and others who seem to be taking medication for long periods of time without any obvious benefits, they haven't re-engaged or changed their level of functioning, and you do then wonder whether it's providing any useful benefits. I guess it's how the medication is taken is probably the area that I find more fascinating. So you'll often have people who will say, look, I have a high pain threshold. I usually avoid taking any pain medication. I don't like taking pain medication. But when I really get to the end of my tether, then I'll take it, and I'll take it at higher doses, you know, for extended periods of time when perhaps they may have taken appropriate medication at an earlier point for shorter periods of time and manage that situation better. So not only the type of medication they're on, but how they're taking it is, I guess, a really important factor that I look at.
Thanks, Nick. Unfortunately, we're coming very close to the end of this really interesting webinar. So I'm going to give each of you 2 minutes to sum up. We've really enjoyed having you all on tonight. And I think I'll start with you, Toby.
Well, I think in summation, I think we've all pointed out chronic pain is a very complex condition. It's a very individualized treatment program that each person requires. It's something where for the patient to be able to understand what their condition is very important, and for them to be validated that what they're experiencing is real. There's, in fact, no such thing as not real pain. Imaginary pain doesn't exist. I dare anyone to look at their thumb and imagine it sore and actually feel the pain. You can't do it. And it's so validation is important, but at the same time, getting them to become an active participant in their own recovery project is vital. For the patient who's waiting for all his therapists to fix him, the process is going to take a very long time and, in fact, won't ever resolve. So it's getting them to become active participants in their own recovery process that, for me, is the most important thing.
Thank you very much, Toby, and thank you very much for your input tonight. Stephen, would you like to sum up in 2 minutes, please?
Certainly. For general practice, I think pain is really interesting. It is why the patients actually present to doctors, and understanding pain gives an insight, you know, into how to treat, what to treat, so forth. And I certainly would like to encourage any GPs that are currently listening to engage in looking more closely into pain, pain medicine, pain management. I think the whole field has expanded so much, you know, in recent years that if you haven't looked at it, a lot of the ideas that you may have, a lot of the concepts might be old concepts. So look into it, look at updating information. It is a fascinating field, and I encourage everybody to do it.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Nick, would you like to sum up your thoughts and also everybody else's, you know, what you've heard tonight in 2 or 3 minutes? Thanks.
Thanks, Michael. Look, I'd like to even back up what Toby then said regarding the treatment approach and the passive versus active, and really encouraging clients to review how their treatment is progressing, what they feel is helping them, and trying to look at finding a way to shift their focus from being a passive recipient of whatever treatment that might be, whether it be from a physio or other treater, to the client actually taking control over their pain. And that's not an easy thing to do, but I think it's a really important thing as clinicians that everything we do aims to increase that self-efficacy, that sense of control the client has over managing their pain. An important part of that is a consistent message, and we can't get that without communicating. So unless, I think, as treaters, we make the effort to pick up the phone and talk to other treaters, whether it be whilst the client is in the room with us or afterwards, that we do communicate with others as a really important part of our treatment approach, not just sending off a letter saying, yes, this is what I've done and thanks very much for the referral, but how can we work together to address barriers towards achieving specific functional goals for the client.
Thank you very much, Nick. Jackie, I will leave you to sum up last for the panel, and one of the reasons I've left you last is that the majority of our attendees tonight are psychologists, so they're from your corner of the ballpark, but I just can't help but think how much we all agree tonight on how our patients should be managed, and it would be nice to have a perfect world, wouldn't it, Jackie?
Definitely. Absolutely. I've been really encouraged by the agreement and the consistency, and that's what's happening more and more as we're understanding the complexities of pain more. There's more consensus about the treatment from different disciplines. And I think that's one of the things that to psychologists or to all treaters, but particularly psychologists, I would emphasise is the importance of function. I think too often as psychologists we forget that DSM criteria that is this impacts function and we end up treating the symptoms. Function engaging in that is part of treatment. It's not once they're feeling better then let's get them back into those roles, let's then get them back to work once they're no longer depressed or their pain is manageable. The two happen concurrently. And obviously that needs to be done in a graduated way. And similar, we have systematic desensitization and grade exposure from a stress or anxiety perspective where you look at the hierarchy. It's exactly the same with pain because you really can't separate out the physical or the psychological factors. So that graded exposure approach that factors in each client's stress and anxiety and pain experience is really important in that treatment approach. Now, obviously, as a psychologist, I have no idea what someone's lifting capacity is or how long they should be able to do things, which is why that multidisciplinary approach is absolutely critical. You asked at the start, Michael, how I got into pain. I started off in a rehab hospital working in a multidisciplinary team and loved working in the area. I then went into private practice where purely as a psychologist with no engagement really with other treaters, tried addressing pain management and had very much worse outcomes, less job satisfaction, less stress. And when you engage with all the different parts, when you can look at the person as a whole person, you get better outcomes for your clients, it's more rewarding, and you start looking at the whole person rather than just looking at their mood and symptoms. So I think that's probably a couple of my key take-home messages.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you, Jackie, Stephen, Toby and Nick. I have learned so much from, I feel very privileged to have been able to facilitate this webinar tonight. The take-home messages that I'm certainly taking home to my practice are the importance of psychoeducation, validation of the patient, active participation, staying up to date as a GP, and I'm sure as all professionals should, the passive versus active management, and stressing self-efficacy, and of course, looking at the end point, which is the return of function. And what I was very impressed with tonight was the emphasis on communication between the GP, psychologist, psychiatrist, and physiotherapist, all important parts of the patient's management. And on behalf of all of our attendees, may I thank you all for the work that you've put in over the last few weeks in preparing this presentation and in coming on tonight. Please ensure, participants, that you complete your exit survey before you log out. If you wish to continue the interdisciplinary discussion, please go to the online forum on MHPN Online. Each participant will be sent a link to online resources associated with this webinar within 48 hours. And the next MHPN webinar, which we hope you will be able to attend, will be Working Together, Working Better to Support Families with Parental Mental Illness. And that will be on August the 15th. Thank you very much for your attendance, and in particular, thank you very much all of our panel. I wish you all a happy future in your practice. Good night.